From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Indian parliamentarians storm out after a Texas-based company wins patents on three varieties of basmati rice. As D.C. police spend millions against IMF World Bank protesters planning to come to the Capitol at the end of September, in Brazil, 400,000 federal employees go on strike after the government, forced by the IMF, cuts education spending. And in Texas, reporter Vanessa Leggett remains in jail for over a month for refusing to hand over her research in a murder case. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Washington Post is reporting that most or all of the human embryonic stem cell colonies approved for research funding under a new Bush policy have been mixed in the laboratory with mouse cells that may carry deadly animal viruses. This means the colonies could be unusable in human trials for scientists trying to turn the colonies into treatments for Parkinson's disease, spinal cord injuries, and other ailments. The standard technique for creating human embryonic stem cell lines has been to extract cells from inside a microscopic embryo, then grow them atop embryonic mouse cells known as feeder cells. The latter excrete some unknown nutritional or growth factor that helps the human cells stay healthy. Because of that, under FDA guidelines designed to prevent the accidental creation of a new plague, it would be difficult, though not impossible, to use the cells in human clinical tests. The cell colonies were created for early-stage research with no thought that they would become the only embryonic cells eligible for federal money. President Bush vowed yesterday that the United States would drop a key arms pact in order to forge ahead with a missile shield Russia says it staunchly opposes. He said of the 1972 anti-ballistic missile accord, "We will withdraw from the ABM treaty on our timetable at a time convenient to America." He also said he had, quote, no specific timetable in mind, a day after U.S. officials scrambled to deny reports that Washington had given Moscow until a November summit to agree to changing the pact. Russia and China are bitterly opposed to the U.S. plan to scrap or sideline the ABM in order to establish a missile shield, and several key U.S. allies believe it could spark a new global arms race. President Bush is likely to name General Richard Myers, a former head of the U.S. Air Force Space Command, as his choice for America's top military officer today. If Bush nominates Myers, who's been on the cutting edge of U.S. high-tech planning, his choice will reflect the importance the President and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld place on a space-based missile defense shield. Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, a multimillionaire former business executive, disclosed yesterday he stayed out of any weapons buying and defense industry merger decisions in order to avoid the appearance of a personal conflict of interest. Rumsfeld, at a Pentagon news conference, mentioned specifically General Dynamics' proposed merger with Newport News Shipbuilding. The Pentagon's preparing a recommendation to the Antitrust Division of the Justice Department on whether it supports the merger. The defense chief, who spent more than 20 years in the corporate world and accumulated assets valued at $60 to $250 million, also said he's avoided Pentagon meetings in which AIDS is discussed. The multimillionaire former businessman has served as chair of the board of the military think tank RAND Corporation and of the drug research company Gilead Sciences, Inc. He also served on the board of directors at business jet maker Gulfstream Aerospace Corporation, which was bought by General Dynamics in 1999. Rumsfeld left the board soon after the purchase. The Bush administration announced yesterday it'll reimburse the district for up to $16 million of the projected $29 million cost of providing security for next month's meetings of the International Monetary Fund and World Bank in Washington. The deal fell short of Washington, D.C.'s request for aid and preparing for as many as 100,000 protesters, but organizers accused D.C. police of inflating the numbers of expected demonstrators to justify the $29 million plan. Matthew Smucker, a 23-year-old organizer with Mobilization for Global Justice, said it's inappropriate for police forces to be used as private security for unpopular global financial institutions. The federal funds, up to $11 million, will go to pay for 3,000 law enforcement officers from other jurisdictions. The government also committed to purchase nearly $5 million worth of riot gear, medical supplies, and operating equipment. D.C. agreed to pay over $4 million to speed up installation of new police communication and video equipment. The $29 million does not include a $2 million, 9-foot-high concrete and metal fence planned to cordon off swaths of downtown to create a security zone around the IMF and World Bank headquarters, meeting sites, and the White House. That expense has been taken over by the Secret Service. This news from Hebron: in a show of military might, Israeli forces stormed into the autonomous Palestinian sector of the divided West Bank city of Hebron, killing two people in retaliation for an attack that wounded an 11-year-old boy. Israeli forces, including some 15 armored vehicles and tanks, entered the district from two directions and had secured the area. Bulldozers demolished several buildings. Before the Hebron raid, Israeli troops shot dead an 11-year-old Palestinian boy in the Gaza Strip and tried to assassinate a Palestinian militant leader in a West Bank missile attack. Also today, Palestinian sources say the Israeli army demolished several acres of farmland and searched through homes in a Palestinian-controlled sector of the Gaza Strip. Separately, a 65-year-old Palestinian died from a heart attack last night after the Israeli army blocked ambulances from evacuating him due to the Israeli curfew imposed on Hebron. And finally, a telecommunications industry group says that federal law enforcement authorities may soon expand the use of a controversial FBI monitoring system to capture email and other text messages sent by cellular phones and other handheld devices, as well as messages from their internet service providers. The FBI has been using the system called Carnivore for 2 years, subject to court authorization, to tap into internet communications, identify email writers online, or record the contents of messages. It does so by capturing packets of information containing those details. Civil liberties advocates and some lawmakers have expressed concern because the system could scan private communication about legal activities of others besides those under investigation. The Justice Department is reviewing the system's impact on privacy. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has given the Texas-based company RiceTech patents on three strains of basmati rice. The decision has provoked an uproar in India, where angry MPs have disrupted Parliament and accused the coalition government of selling out to foreign interests. 4 years ago, RiceTech attempted to register basmati as a trademark, but later it withdrew several of its patent applications in the face of overwhelming opposition. But last week, the Patent Office allowed it to register three hybrid versions of basmati: Texmati, Jasmati, and Kasmati. It produced the varieties by crossbreeding basmati seed with U.S. long-grain rice. RiceTech was also given permission to claim that its brands are superior to basmati. Basmati rice has been growing for centuries in the foothills of the Himalayas. The Indian government insisted yesterday that the ruling would not affect India's lucrative basmati exports to the United States. But other campaigners say the case shows how Western corporations are using the World Trade Organization's patent laws to exploit poor farmers in the developing world. We first go to Bruce Hicks, who's spokesperson for RiceTech in Texas. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you start off by talking about the significance of your winning the patents?
Well, let me cover some things, because unfortunately some of the things you said in the lead-in, which came from other media, obviously, are just not correct at all. I'm going to give a quick thumbnail of the background. 4 years ago, RiceTech was granted a patent which protected three varieties of basmati rice that RiceTech had developed over 10 years of normal breeding, not GMO type work. And since that time, there was a request for reexamination filed by a law firm out of Minneapolis who's always refused to identify their client, but it's assumed to be the Indian government. And as the result of that reexamination, which finally occurred last week, five of the claims in our patent were upheld. Those are the ones that protect the three varieties. Other claims were either removed voluntarily by RiceTech or struck down by the patent office. But the end result is a good result for everybody involved. The Indian government and the Indian Pakistani trade can certainly, I think, take comfort that the issues they had in terms of the potential they thought there might be of some interference with their trade is removed. It also protects for RiceTech our investment in our varieties of basmati, which have no impact on anybody else. Our patent doesn't affect anybody else or anything like that. So this was really a reaffirmation of elements of our patent, and that's what occurred recently. We think it's very important because it should put this issue to rest, except for those who have other agendas, who have other issues they want to raise, and those will continue. Whether this issue is resolved by anybody else.
Well, let me ask you about some of the major issues that critics, that the Indian MPs, that a lot of the Indian population raises. For example, the issue of biopiracy. RiceTech used genes from the Public Breeding Institute in India, and yet ultimately you now have them trademarked and you will be profiting from them.
We don't have them trademarked at all. And in fact, the seeds came from public seed bank, just like they do all over the world for lots of other companies. And there's no biopiracy involved at all. It's no different than if we took the rice or some other grain from the institute. And whether we had a patent or not would not impact whether we grew the crop. That's what they're there for. Is to be used in research to grow other strains and so forth. I mean, that's the whole purpose of it, is to help feed a hungry world. And whether we have a patent or not wouldn't change whether we were growing the rice. In fact, without the patent, the Indian market is probably at greater risk because it would mean that our rice strains in this country could be available to any of the competitors in this country growing vast amounts of it, as opposed to the little bitty tiny company that we are.
What about the issue of the Biodiversity Convention, the obligation to share benefits of genetic resources, to perhaps pay royalties, benefit sharing?
Well, that's certainly not a resolved issue at all, and it's a much broader issue than anything RiceTech is involved in or appropriately involved in. I think there are others who are probably better equipped to have that debate. We're a company that has one single patent on to protect some varieties that we created over 10 years of breeding. There are others out there. There are tens of thousands of plant patents and the like in this country. I think there are other companies, Monsanto, Del Monte, et cetera, who probably could be involved in that argument much better than we can.
Finally, this whole reaction to the patenting of life. I mean, the other day we were talking with a Wall Street Journal reporter who was dealing with the issue of cloning and overall this kind of patenting and the idea of it violating the 13th Amendment, which is the amendment against slavery. But it goes back
please,
to the...
Please, Amy, do not drag us into a ludicrous argument like that. We have nothing to do with cloning or any of those other...
No, but the whole idea of the patenting of life.
This is plotting of a plant seed. It is very common in this country. Again, we have one such patent. There are tens of thousands held by other companies. Those are the ones you might want to talk to. We just don't happen to agree with that viewpoint, but it has nothing, and it would be ludicrous to draw us into such an argument over cloning, for goodness sakes.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Bruce Hicks is a spokesperson for RiceTech, which is the company that the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has just given patents on three strains of basmati rice to. Thanks for joining us from RiceTech in Texas. We now go to Sophia Murphy, who's director of the trade program at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about your concerns about the patenting of basmati rice and the awarding of these patents to RiceTech?
I guess for us it raises a number of points. The biggest is just a fundamental worldview, I guess, that I just listening to the end of that interview, I can hear a different understanding about what seeds are and what genetic resources are, who they belong to. And at a basic level for us, we oppose the patenting of life, and seeds are a life form because we believe that belongs in the public domain. And over centuries, people have changed and adapted seeds to meet the needs where they grow their food, and we feel that's something that needs to stay in the public realm because everyone has a right to food. Everyone ought to have access to what they need to stay alive. So I guess at a very big level, we have a problem. And then we have specific issues around what exactly RiceTech has done that means it can patent an entire seed and type of basmati rice. What did it change exactly in that seed that makes it the company's property now instead of the property of the farmers in the Punjab where the basmati seed has been developed over time? We question whether you can apply something that was developed for mechanical processes to something as complex as genetic structure of life forms.
Can you talk about this concept of biopiracy? I mean, the question that I asked Bruce Hicks about using the genetic material from the public genetic pool in India and then privatizing it, patenting it, and then making a profit off it.
I can tell you we completely don't agree with that as an approach to managing our genetic resources. We're deeply concerned that this knowledge, you know, this seed in a way is a form of knowledge and that knowledge belongs in the public domain. It's not something that, you know, I don't mind RiceTech developing rice and making money from growing rice. Farmers are trying to make money from growing rice in a sense as well. The issue is the ownership that they're trying to claim and trying to shut out other people from using something that I would say by heritage and by right is theirs, ours. So I guess that's what I was saying at the beginning about a difference in worldview. We just don't accept the basic principle that the patent office is upholding for the moment, that a company has the right to have this kind of proprietary knowledge over something as basic as a genetic resource.
And what about the Biodiversity Convention, the obligation to share benefits of genetic resources? Now, I wish I could have asked you these questions together, but Bruce Hicks was not willing to go on with an adversary. He said that on this narrow issue of patents for these different kinds of rice, he didn't want to be drawn into a larger debate about issues that they really have nothing to do with.
Yeah, I mean, well, it doesn't know that he needed to debate or not. I can certainly say I think that it's very easy to say, oh, we're just a little piece of the problem and go talk to people who have more patents. I think you either buy into that system or you don't. And they clearly have bought into the system. It suits them and it will make them money. But I think that to say that, well, we're not really the problem is to ignore the nature of what they're doing. There are moral questions underlying these issues. And if RiceTech chooses not to see it in those terms, I guess it's its choice. But I don't understand how it can say that because we only do it on one plant variety, that makes it not important. Look at somebody who's doing it on 10, and then you should have the discussion.
Right, as he said, go call Monsanto or Del Monte.
Right.
But the Biodiversity Convention.
Yeah, back to CBD. So the Biological Diversity Convention, I mean, ITP, the institute where I work, put a lot of time and energy into trying to ensure that at the multilateral level, there would be rules to ensure benefit sharing because we oppose the view that the companies have pushed, which is that they have a right to proprietary knowledge over genetic resources. And in many, many cases, almost all cases, these plants are developed and have been developed over thousands of years. So they're something that for us belong in a public domain. And it links to another international agreement on trade-related intellectual property rights, TRIPS, which is housed at the World Trade Organization. And that's an agreement that allows patenting on life and has encouraged this kind of behavior, if you like, from private sector. It's encouraged a privatization of public knowledge And we see the Convention on Biological Diversity as a way to redress that and to provide a larger view. We're saying that trade is not a large enough perspective to have to address these issues.
We've been speaking with Sophia Murphy, Director of the Trade Program at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy in Minneapolis. Sophia, could you just tell us where people can go on the web for more information about gene patenting?
They can go to the Genetic Resources Library that IATP runs, and from there it links to many other sites and organizations working on these issues. You can either go www.iatp.org and scroll through the program areas. Trade and Agriculture is the program that houses our biotechnology site. You can also go straight to www.wtowatch.org. The WTO Watch site has all the information related to the World Trade Organization, including patent rights.
Well, thanks for being with us again, Sophia Murphy.
My pleasure.
And as we go into our break, we're going to come back and we're going to take this issue again around the world, looking at examples of indigenous people who take on large corporations. We'll be talking about resource rebels. You're listening to Rebel Radio, Democracy Now! Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Anti-globalization activists went to court this past week to stop Washington police from erecting a 9-foot-high fence to keep protesters away from next month's meeting of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. Law enforcement agencies are preparing for the more than 100,000 demonstrators to jam the nation's capital in an effort to disrupt meetings. In the past 2 years, clashes between police and protesters at similar meetings have resulted in hundreds of injuries, arrests, and one death. In a lawsuit filed in federal court, activists charged the security precautions violate their constitutional rights to freedom of speech, assembly, and petition. The protest leaders say their movement has been demonized by police and the mainstream news media. The media, they say, has ridiculed their cause as incoherent because the protesters are raising so many different issues. Well, we're joined right now by Al Geddix, who's just come out with a new book, which articulates one facet of the anti-globalization platform very clearly. In his book, Resource Rebels, Native Challenges to Mining and Oil Corporations, he argues that the World Bank and IMF are responsible for the killing of indigenous people around the world. He joins us now from the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Al Geddix, why don't you start by telling us about the general thesis of your book?
The basic idea is that despite the widespread perception that the major genocide and ethnocide of native populations were a product of the 19th century, my argument is that this process is ongoing in the 20th century and, in fact, has accelerated in the 20th century and in the decade that we're in right now for a number of reasons, one of which is that the financing of these projects have shifted from individual corporations and shareholders to multilateral lending institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, who are only funding the largest projects, the most profitable projects, and those projects which happen to be located in unexploited areas of the globe, which are almost uniformly in the areas inhabited by native peoples. When you have those kind of projects on those kind of scales inserted into these delicate ecosystems inhabited by native peoples, you have widespread environmental destruction. And as I document in the book, you also have widespread political resistance to those projects, which has necessitated, from the point of view of the state and the corporations, massive amounts of military intervention into those areas to quash the native resistance. And, of course, that whole dynamic of quashing native resistance simply feeds the dynamic of requiring even more raw materials and even more energy to manufacture the tanks and the helicopters and provide the fuel for these kinds of invasions. So on the one hand, you have this increased assault on native peoples at the same time as you have an incredible revolution in the ability of native peoples to make connections with international environmental, human rights, native rights organizations, make coalitions with these groups in the advanced industrial countries to put pressure on precisely those kind of multilateral institutions like the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund that are financing this genocidal and ethnocidal assault.
Can you talk about West Papua as a case study?
West Papua is one of the most extreme examples of a handful of mining corporations led by Freeport-McMoRan, which is based in New Orleans, along with its British partner Rio Tinto, which is the world's largest mining corporation, trying to essentially remove a mountain of gold and copper in an area inhabited by native populations assisted by the military government of Indonesia, beginning with Suharto, continuing with the recent administration of Wahid and accelerating, in fact, under the present administration of Megawati. But the basic idea of the Freeport mine is to remove the native people from areas of mineralization, which is done with the assistance of the Indonesian military, and also assisted by the private security forces of Freeport mining itself. The result of that whole process has been not only the removal and displacement of native people, but the massive deposition of waste material or mine tailings, which are toxic materials containing heavy metals and acids that are being discharged on a daily basis of 100,000 tons per day, that are being discharged without any kind of treatment into the rivers and streams that the native people depend on for their food harvesting, for their drinking water, for their fishing, and for their farming. What it has done has resulted in the ethnocidal assault on native populations in West Papua. And, of course, this whole process has been financed not only by international lending institutions, but also by direct military assistance from the United States to the Indonesian military.
We're talking to Professor Al Gettings, who has written a book called Resource Rebels. He is a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, talking about West Papua and Freeport-McMoRan and indigenous resistance. That's a theme of the book also. It's not just about the exploitation of indigenous people, but as you said, how indigenous people form coalitions with environmental groups and others. When we cover the big anti-globalization demonstrations, you'll see groups of people marching down the street from India, from West Papua, from Colombia, with their Western counterpart groups like the Rainforest Action Network. How are these alliances being formed, and how are people back at the company end of things, where the homes of, say, corporations like Freeport-McMoRan are, coming to know about these struggles?
Well, part of the revolution in the organizational capacity of these native groups in various parts of the Third World, primarily, has been assisted by a change in the consciousness of environmental and human rights organizations in the advanced industrial countries, who are beginning to understand much more clearly that the issues that they are concerned about, global environmental issues like global warming, acid rain, deforestation, that all of these processes cannot be directly addressed without recognizing that the people that are in these areas, in the tropical rainforests, in these sensitive environments, are being wiped out by these mining and oil activities, and that in order to make an effective response to slow down and reverse the process of global warming, deforestation, one has to provide material assistance, organizational assistance, information, most importantly, about what the effects of these technologies, these mining and oil extractive technologies, are going to be for these mega projects that are being proposed all around the world. And information flows two ways. It not only flows from the developed countries to the third world, but the information then about what the personal and human impacts of these technologies are for these native peoples then gets transmitted back to the developed countries in forms such as presentations at shareholder meetings of mining corporations and oil corporations, where groups like Rainforest Action Network and Amazon Watch and Project Underground, to name just a couple, have brought native people from these rainforest areas to the centers of corporate decision-making in America, and for the first time provided direct, dramatic eyewitness testimony to what the effects of these investments are on Native people. They have done that not just in shareholder meetings, but they have done that at the World Bank, presentations for Native people directly confront the decision-makers at the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, as well as private or intergovernmental agencies like the Agency for International Development in the United States. All of these agencies have had their consciousness raised by the coordinating and mobilization capacity of environmental organizations that have put pressure on these institutions to stop financing and stop promoting the kind of projects that are resulting in this assault on Native peoples.
Do you see that these corporations like Chevron in Nigeria or Occidental and Columbia Freeport in West Papua simply see these as PR problems and are just developing slicker ways to cover up what they do?
For the most part, the corporations you mentioned, Freeport, Chevron, British Petroleum, do in fact see these as public relations problems. And part of their response to criticism of their activities has been to agree to these protocols such as the Code of Behavior for Mining and Oil Corporations, which was recently promoted by Secretary of State Madeleine Albright and the British Foreign Secretary as a way of responding to criticisms of the accusations of the participation of these corporations in the murder, torture, and destruction of native cultures in the places where they operate. However, there's another level at which these corporations have had to confront the consequences of their actions, and that is that when the pipeline of financing is jeopardized, as it has been in all of these cases of Freeport and Chevron, of multilateral financing of their oil and mining activities in the third world, that is when they have had to pay attention to the consequences of their activities in these remote places of the world. When financing has been threatened or stopped, as it has in the case of, for instance, Occidental Petroleum in Colombia, where the Rainforest Action Network and Amazon Watch have put pressure on Fidelity Investments and now on the Bernstein Investment Company to withdraw their financing from Occidental's oil development in Colombia. When those kinds of pressures are brought to bear, there is a different level of response, not necessarily from the company, but from the industry. And if you look at the mining industry journals and the oil industry journals, They are saying that the behavior of some of these corporations like Freeport and Chevron and Occidental are in fact threatening future investments in those areas in Latin America, Asia, and Africa where there are still untapped resources that corporations want to get at.
Professor Geddix, what about the ascendancy of the oiligarchy, of Bush-Cheney, both oil men themselves? Have you seen a quantitative or qualitative leap in terms of oil exploitation? And what does it mean for Native Americans here in the United States?
During the previous several decades, there was some minimal attempt to provide tribes with resources to develop alternative sources of energy, for instance, particularly in the plain states, and particularly wind energy. And that was going to not only reduce our dependence on foreign energy supplies, but also going to provide a sustainable basis for the economic development of impoverished Western American Indian tribes. Under Bush and Cheney, all of those funds for renewable development, economic development on Indian reservations have been, for the most part, shut off. And the only alternative alternatives that are being financed are the fossil fuels and the nuclear power plants. And what we have seen under Bush and Cheney is a renewed assault on coal and uranium resources on American Indian reservations, which is comparable to the kind of assault that took place in the aftermath of the Arab oil embargo in the 1970s when the Nixon administration proposed a energy independence program that resulted in massive environmental destruction on the Navajo and Hopi reservation, for instance, in the Southwest, under the guise of promoting energy independence. What we're seeing a replay of those same kinds of environmental and cultural assaults on Native lands and Native resources.
What about the renewed interest in clean coal and clean coal technology? How does that interface with Native American rights?
I think the rhetoric about clean coal technology is a very sophisticated public relations ploy to detract attention from the mounting scientific evidence that coal development is not only unsustainable in terms of the material distribution of resources, but unsustainable from the point of view of the effects it's having on global warming, the effects it's having on the health of people who have to breathe the air that is contaminated by mercury and other toxic emissions from fossil fuel mining and fossil fuel processing and consumption. So I think it's more appearance than it is reality. The importance of the clean coal initiative it is in terms of diverting attention from the fact that there is, in fact, no clean coal technology. That for the most part, if you look at the effects of those minor alterations in the amount of pollutants with clean coal technologies, it's not going to materially affect the trend of global warming, nor is it going to affect the health threat of burning those fossil fuels on the people that have to breathe the air from those emissions.
Al Geddix, author of Resource Rebels, Native Challenges to Mining and Oil Corporations, professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, La Crosse, and longtime activist in environmental and Native solidarity movements. His book is published by South End Press. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're headed down to Brazil to find out why hundreds of thousands of people are out on strike, and then we'll talk to the Committee to Protect Journalists about a Texas reporter who's been in jail for over a month because she refuses to hand over documents. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. In some South American countries, concern is growing about the link between debt and structural adjustment. The International Monetary Fund says their loans foster economic growth and provide temporary financial assistance to countries to help ease balance of payments adjustment. In Brazil this week, as many as 400,000 federal employees voted to walk off the job after government announced a wage increase for federal employees that their unions say is inadequate. According to union leaders, the strike has everything to do with Brazil's new accord with the IMF. A loan is intended to buffer Brazil from the economic crisis engulfing neighboring Argentina, but it's resulted in massive cuts in federal programs, especially education. We're turning now to Marilia Washington, who is vice president of the Sao Paulo chapter of the Association of Higher Education Teachers, recently retired professor of education at San Carlos Federal University. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Marilia Washington.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us.
I'm very pleased to be with you all, so thanks a lot.
Well, can you tell us why so many thousands of professors are out on strike?
Well, I think that you have already anticipated a number of reasons for our strike. You know, we are facing maybe one of the deepest crises we have in the country in the recent history of Brazil. It is an economic, political, and social crisis, and it has everything to do with all the accords with the Monetary Fund. We have a unpayable external debt that is raising now to about 52% of our GNP. Only in terms of pay interest on that debt, it is taking some 42.6% of the national net revenue. Add to that abusive taxation on the working classes, cutbacks in all kinds of financing in social areas, meaning education, health, social security, housing for low-income citizens, public safety, and so on. So our strike has everything to do with this context within which the federal government decided that we should not, civil servants, the federal civil servants, should not have any readjustment in our salaries, and it has been going on for the last 7 years. So, for your audience to have an idea of the situation, if we're talking about the payroll, the federal payroll, it has decreased from 56% to 37% of our net revenue. It's very far from the legal limit the federal government has for its payroll. In terms of higher education, federal institutions of higher education, the financing has dropped from 9.2% to 3.7% of our net revenue. We're talking about federal universities, colleges, and high schools, and we have a number of hospitals, university hospitals as well. We are now going into our third day of strike, and in terms of the federal system of higher education, I have just been informed that we have some 40 universities and colleges, plus maybe 100 high schools, federal high schools, on strike right now.
And what is the government saying, Marilee Washington?
The government says we are demanding too much. After we are not asking for a raise in salary in terms, well, I work hard, so I deserve a raise. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about inflation that has it's accumulated in about 74% in 7 years.
Do you see, do you see the anti-globalization protests that are taking place all over the world? The next one set for Washington, September 28th, 29th, 30th, to close down the IMF and the World Bank. Do you see them related to your struggle in Brazil?
Yes, because our crisis, the economic, social, political crisis, is a result of the policies implemented by some kind of imposition of the Monetary Fund and the World Bank. So they determine what we must do, not only in Brazil, but in most of the underdeveloped, so-called underdeveloped countries. They are imposing too much, including the kinds of cutbacks that the governments must implement.
Marilee Washington, thanks so much for joining us. Marilee Washington is the vice president of the Sao Paulo chapter of the Association of Higher Education Teachers, recently retired professor of education at San Carlos Federal University in Brazil. Again, there are more than 450,000 federal employees are on strike. And now we go to a national issue, to Texas. Vanessa Leggett has been in jail since July 20th, when she was found in contempt of court for refusing to turn over her research materials about a high-profile murder case to federal prosecutors. Leggett has been working on a book about the case. She said she would not turn over her notes to a grand jury investigating the murder of 40-year-old Doris Angleton, wife of millionaire former bookie Robert Angleton. The International Federation of Journalists, the American Society of Newspaper Editors, the Committee to Protect Journalists, and the Society of Professional Journalists have all condemned her jailing. They argue the use of similar subpoenas could allow prosecutors to use journalists as private investigators, restricting the free flow of information to the public. And we're joined right now by representatives of two of those groups. Marilyn Smates is with us from the Americas Program at the Committee to Protect Journalists. And Ray Marcano joins us from Chicago, president of the Society of Professional Journalists. Ray Marcano, let's begin with you. Can you first lay out Vanessa Leggett's case? What exactly happened to her?
Well, she was researching a book on the 1997 murder of Doris Angleton, and Angleton is the wife of Robert Angleton, a millionaire ex-bookie who was, I think he was acquitted in 1998 of hiring his brother to commit the murder. And researching information for the book, the Justice Department, for reasons unknown to all of us, decided to swoop down and demand to see her notes, demand to hear her tape recordings, and when she refused to turn that over, the government, for reasons unknown to us, decided to throw her in jail.
And have you dealt with a case like this before?
Oh, yeah, we've dealt with cases in which reporters have been arrested for doing their job. This is the first time in a while, however, that we have dealt with a case in which a private citizen, using her First Amendment rights to gather information, has been thrown into jail because she refuses to share that with a government entity.
Now, what do you say to those who argue this involves a murder case, and any information that can be gathered on this should be turned over so that the guilty parties can be dealt with?
Well, what I say to that is we have arms of the government that do investigation. That's why you have police departments. That's why you have the FBI. That's why you have justice. they're the ones that should be doing the investigations. In our society, individuals should be allowed to gather information for the purposes of dissemination, and that's what Vanessa Leggett was doing. Whether or not she's a journalist is immaterial as far as we're concerned. We're very interested in sticking up for the First Amendment rights of all citizens.
What do you mean, whether or not she's a journalist?
Well, there's some dispute as to whether or not Vanessa Leggett is a journalist. The reason the Justice Department, from what we can gather, has elected to throw her into jail is because she does not fit the Justice Department's definition of who a journalist is or what a journalist should be. Our position is that no government entity should make that determination. The fact of the matter is she was gathering information for public dissemination, and whether or not she is or isn't a journalist is immaterial. In this country, you have the right to do that, and the government should not be in the position of jailing our citizens who exercise their rights.
Mary Lane Smates, why has the Committee to Protect Journalists got involved with this case? I think of that as much more an international organization.
Yes, you're right. We, in general, focus on press freedom attacks in countries where we feel our efforts are most needed, in non-industrialized countries. But we do take up cases in the U.S. when we feel that those cases will have a very widespread and damaging effects on journalists, both in the United States and abroad. And we definitely feel that the case of Vanessa Leggett is an example of that. We're very worried about this case for the same reasons that Mr. Marcano explained. And we also are very alarmed about the signal that the jailing of Vanessa Leggett sends to other countries that regularly resort to the jailing of journalists. We feel that the international outcry that the jailing of journalists has generated has contributed to there being less journalists in jail right now than a few years ago. And so we feel that the U.S. jailing a journalist is sending exactly the wrong signal to other countries. So that's why we've taken up this case and written a letter to Mr. Ashcroft protesting the jailing of Ms. Leggett.
And what has been the Attorney General's response?
We have not received any response as of yet to our August 7 letter. We would, of course, be very interested to receive it after all.
Ray Marcano, where are the notes of Vanessa Leggett right now as she remains in jail?
Well, they're with Vanessa Leggett, which is where they should be. They shouldn't be in the hands of the government. And she's keeping them, and she's keeping them under wraps.
What are newspaper organizations in this country doing right now to support her? Are they?
Well, some newspaper organizations have taken up our challenge of helping contribute funds to her legal defense. Her lawyer has capped his fee at $25,000. SPJ has contributed half of that, and we're asking other media organizations to make up the difference. Many of them have stepped forward. Others are taking intermediate steps. ABC News, CNN, and some others joined SPJ and other groups in opening up her appeal hearing. Originally, judges wanted to keep that closed, but we fought that in court, and it was opened up.
On an international level, Mary Lane Smates, we're seeing at these anti-globalization protests, most recently in Genoa, that the independent journalists feel that they are actually being targeted, that the IMCs are being hit by police, they're being raided, because they want to gather their material. They want their videos. They want their audio tape recordings to use them as a kind of, evidence-gathering arm or way to look at the protesters in terms of pictures. Have you seen an increasing trend of this?
I have to say that there have been a number of such cases. You mentioned Italy. We've also seen such cases in Canada, in the U.S. during protests that occurred over the last year. Yes, I would say there is an alarming amount of such cases. And CPJ has, for instance, also come out protesting what happened to journalists during the protests in Genoa.
And finally, Ray Marcano, I mean, there is a history, the U.S. government with the CIA, for example, abroad, of infiltrating newspaper organizations. And I think a lot has come out in congressional hearings over the years, like the Church hearings of the 70s, where either a news organization would knowingly allow someone working for the CIA to pose as a journalist, or they would just be infiltrated. They didn't know. And it's certainly the best cover someone gathering information could have, because they're doing the same kind of thing. Do you see an increasing trend of this, or do you think we're getting away from this?
Well, I don't see an increasing trend of government officials posing as journalists. I do see an increasing trend of the government trampling on the First Amendment rights of journalists by arresting them when they try to do their job, by taking them down to police stations in an effort to confiscate their film while they're trying to do their job. That is an extremely troubling trend that all media organizations in this country, including SPJ, are fighting routinely.
Last comment on Vanessa Leggett. If people want to get more information on her case, where can they go?
Well, they can always call the Society of Professional Journalists office at 317-927-8000. They can also look at our website, which is at spj.org. Very easy to remember.
Do you see a conclusion to this case soon? How long do you think Ms. Leggett will remain in jail?
My hope is that she will be released from jail quickly, but given the government's incredible recalcitrance on this matter, I don't see that happening.
And Mary Lane Smates, if people want to get in touch with Committee to Protect Journalists.
Then they're very welcome to visit our website, which is very much like SPJ's website, so also easy to remember. It's www.cpj.org, and there people can find the letter that we sent to Mr. Ashcroft.
And it's a very excellent website, by the way.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you both for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Ray Marcano is president of the Society of Professional Journalists, and Mary Lane Smates is with the Committee to Protect Journalists. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And please email us. It's mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson. Anthony Sloan is our engineer, and music maestro Errol Maitland, our technical director. Special thanks to Miranda Kennedy and Chase. I want to thank all the Pacifica stations, particularly KPFA, and all of our affiliates. We are Pacifica. We are broadcasting from downtown community television in the historic firehouse of Engine 31 in Chinatown. In exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and the Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now! As we go out with Sly and the Family Stone, Stand.
Stand for the things you know, all right. It's the truth that the truth makes them so alive. Stand.
All the things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no deal. Crawl, and they know what you're saying makes sense at all.